Please be seated. Janet's going to come and read to us from Isaiah chapter 5.
The reading is from Isaiah chapter 5, verses 1 to 7. I will sing for the one I love a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut out a winepress as well. Then he looked for a good crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. Now you dwellers in Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done for my vineyard than I have done for it? When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? Now I will tell you what I am going to do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, and it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall, and it will be trampled. I will make it a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and briars and thorns will grow there. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the nation of Israel, and the people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. And he looked for justice, but saw bloodshed, for righteousness, but heard cries of distress. Thanks be to God.
If you've got Isaiah chapter 5 in front of you, you'll find it really helpful this morning. For a start, you want to check that I'm not just making all this up as I go along. You're starting a series of parables and kicking off with these seven verses in Isaiah chapter 5, the first seven verses. It's a parable. It's also a poem. It's headed up in my version of the Bible, at least, as a song. It's a prophecy. It's all those things. So you're getting a lot for your seven verses here. And stories, of course, are a great way of communicating, aren't they? They are things that move us. When we listen to a story, our guard is down in the way that maybe it's not if somebody's giving us a more formal presentation. You get drawn in. You get engaged as people tell stories. And perhaps you get emotionally moved as well. Can we have the slide up, please? Thank you. That's brilliant. In Burnham-on-Sea, we are partnered with a church in Albania. This is a fairly recent thing. We've been doing it for getting on for 2 years, 18 months, something like that. And we go out to Albania. Now, I could tell you about Albania by showing you a map and pointing out where it is. It's right next to Greece. I could give you some statistics about it. I could give you some great graphs and charts and everything, tell you some of the history of it. And you would, I think, probably, given that not many people know very much about Albania, myself included, you'd learn something about Albania. Or I could instead tell you stories of heroic pastors like Anea, who is here meeting in the church there. And Anea is pastoring in a very difficult situation, not really knowing each month where his support is going to come from. And yet he's faithfully and doggedly serving the church in that way. Or I could tell you about the poverty by showing you some pictures and telling you stories behind some of those pictures. So last Christmas, we took a whole bunch of shoeboxes out for children as part of what we do as a church. There, it's part of a Weber initiative, so you may have heard about this initiative already. And we've taken it to the next stage, if you like, by formally partnering with the church. So this lady here in the middle, the rest of the people, two of whom you may recognize, were there visiting, helping out, giving little bits of talks in various gatherings that they had and giving out the shoeboxes. This woman in the middle lives in that room with her daughter. And that is her room. That is it. What you see is pretty much all you get. There is a refrigerator in the corner here. Such a small space. We were so cramped together that I couldn't get everything in on the picture. So there's a refrigerator and there's a TV on top of it. Other than that, there's a stove on the left, which is for heating and for cooking. And you can tell here that these beds have got all the bedding piled up in the corner because that's where they sleep as well. So I could tell you about the poverty, or I could show you a graph about it, and then I could talk to you about the wonderful reaction you get from the children. Children who, as you saw from the previous picture, have got so little. So suddenly a little box with goodies from the UK means a great deal to those kids. And it might be some little kind of stocking filler toys that we might give our kids. It might be stuff that we wouldn't dare give our kids for Christmas, like toothpaste and soap. Because our kids would be horrified and bored by it, because obviously you've got that stuff. You haven't necessarily got those things here. So unless you're really into a bar chart, and there's probably a time of prayer for you afterwards if you are, then I think the stories are going to be the things that you remember. The stories are going to be the things that move you, that engage you and stay with you. That's why you might not remember anything else today, but you might remember a story that somebody has told you. Stories pack a punch. They sneak past our defences. In the Old Testament, the prophet Nathan has got a huge job to do. He knows about King David's affair. Now, how do you go about confronting your king about something that he's doing wrong? Now, some prophets would bottle it and go the other way. Others might try and give it in with two barrels. He is very wise and very careful. Rather than confront David and perhaps get a flat denial followed by a trip to the tower, he talks to him and he tells him a story, and you'll know this story. Nathan tells the story about a little sheep, and he's a sweet little sheep, and it's a lovely sheep. It's the only sheep that this poor man's got. And then a nasty man comes along and says, I'm going to have that sheep. And suddenly he hasn't got a sheep at all, this poor man. It's just wrong, isn't it? And David, as you'll know, takes the bait, and he explodes with indignation at the injustice of all this. How dare you do this to this poor man? This man must die, he shouts. And at that point, Nathan knows he's got him bang to rights. Because he says, you are the man. This was you. This is what you did. Stories are great for drawing us in. P.G. Woodhouse, who I'm not educated enough to read particularly, once said, a parable is one of those stories in the Bible which sounds like a pleasant yarn, but keeps something up its sleeve which pops up and knocks you flat. You think you're listening to a lovely story about the prodigal son. Suddenly you realize, hang on, I'm the prodigal son. Or you perhaps think, actually, I'm the older brother. You think you're listening to a story, you find out you're in the story. And this Old Testament parable that we're looking at this morning in Isaiah chapter 5, whether it's a song or a poem or a parable, I think it's all of those things. In chapter 5, I think you can imagine Isaiah has a guitar strapped around his neck and is singing to them. And this is the song that he sings. I will sing for the one I love, a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and he cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut out a winepress as well. Some of you will know what you're doing on allotments and in gardens. I don't really. I am no gardener. But when I lived in Canterbury, we lived in an old council house, one of those old council houses which had a lovely big garden on the back of it, one of the older ones. And there was a patch of ground there that had perhaps in the past been used as a vegetable patch. So I tried to grow veg there. And because it had been neglected quite a while, it was full of stones, full of old bits of concrete, also full, bizarrely, of broken sheets of glass, which somebody in their wisdom had decided this was the ideal spot to bury them in. And clearing stuff like that out, as you know, is hard work. You dig it again, and then you finally get to the stage where you can plant the vegetables. So I did this, and I watered, and I weeded, and what did I do every few days? I toddled up the garden path to see something must have happened by now. Because that's what you do, isn't it? You're expecting a crop. You want to see this stuff come up. It's never quite as quick as you think it is it? Well, that's what's going on here at the start of this song. The ground we read is fertile. It's been dug up. All the stones have been removed. It's good soil. And it's planted, notice, with the choicest vines. These are good quality plants. This isn't the stuff that's half dying in a corner of a garden centre, which I sometimes mistakenly by thinking, I'm sure I can rescue that. It doesn't always work, does it? This is being done properly. And you can tell that the vineyard owner has high expectations too, because he builds a watchtower to live in. He builds a wine press somewhere to store the wine that he's expecting to get in from this crop. And it even looks, if we look at verse 5, like it was double fenced. There's a hedge mentioned and a wall. But, as you'll have heard in the reading, when the time comes, he looks for good grapes, we read in verse 2, but finds only bad. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. Now, you dwellers in Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done for my vineyard than I have done for it? When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? Now I'll tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I'll take away its hedge, it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall and it will be trampled. I will make it a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and briars and thorns will grow there. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. So having had the expectation of finding really good fruit, all that's found there is bad fruit. Actually, the Hebrew, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but the Hebrew is literally, apparently, stink fruit. This stuff is rotten. This stuff is rancid. And you know the feeling, don't you, if you've ever tried to plant a garden and it doesn't take the way that you want it to? So disappointing, isn't it? You think, why have I spent all that time out there, however many hours, backbreaking work sometimes, nothing to show for it? Looking for good, only finding the bad. Nothing for it then, other than to rip it all out. So the vineyard owner, we see there in verse 5, is going to destroy and trample, rip out the hedges and knock down the stone wall. The vineyard will be uncultivated and unprotected. Briars and thorns are going to grow up there because of the neglect. And it's even going to be a wasteland, an arid one at that, because no rain will fall there. Now, at this point, I think people listening to Isaiah's song will be thinking, God, that's awful. We're with you on this. This is so unfair. You deserved a much better return than what you got. You were right to expect a good crop. But then there's that twist in the tail. This is where the hand, the fist, slips up out of the sleeve and knocks us back. Verse 7. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the nation of Israel, and the people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. And he looked for justice, but he saw bloodshed, for righteousness, but heard cries of distress. At this point, the penny drops. The quicker people that are listening to his song for the first time will suddenly be saying, oh, okay, so this is a parable of God's people. And so the one who planted the vineyard and was looking after it is God himself. And that explains the business of why Isaiah starts his song about the business of the one I love and my loved one, because we know Isaiah loves his God, so that makes sense. And then you can imagine as they're talking about themselves, perhaps somebody else saying, yes, and it was very clever, wasn't it? I loved the wordplay. The language was very, very clever. Now, we don't get this unless we are Hebrew scholars. But there are a couple of words here, a couple of puns that really kind of help make it more memorable. So the word there in verse 7 for justice and the word for bloodshed sounds very, very similar in Hebrew. But they obviously mean completely different things. And likewise, with righteousness and distress, came looking for righteousness. Instead, he found distress. Again, very similar sounding words, very different things. And then you can imagine somebody in the audience thinking, hang on, is he talking about us then? Because if he is, this is really rude. He's being really, does he know what he's saying to us? Of course he does. Suddenly it's personal, because he's saying, yeah, he's saying we all produce stink fruit. We're not very fruitful, we're a rubbish crop, and that our sense of justice and righteousness in particular stinks. Suddenly they've engaged with it and it's hit home, hasn't it? Suddenly this isn't a story for them to listen to. It's a profound statement of who they are. They're not just the listeners in this story. The people of Judah and Israel are in it. And of course, as followers of Jesus, we are in this as well. Because this is a parable of God's people and what God is looking for. God is looking for a good crop. He is looking for us to be fruitful. When we belong to Christ, as his followers, we are called, aren't we, to live differently. Differently to the way that we used to live. and probably differently to the way that most people around us live. To quote John the Baptist, you and I are charged to produce fruit in accordance with... I haven't got that down. I thought I had. Sorry. To produce fruit in accordance with repentance. So if we repented, we should be living a different lifestyle. If we've repented, we should be living to different standards to those around us. And it's at this point that if you've got your Bible open in front of you, you'll find this helpful, because I'm not going to read the rest of the chapter, but we do need to refer to the rest of the chapter if we're going to understand fully what's going on here. Sometimes Jesus told parables, didn't he? And people just went away, frankly, most of them went away scratching their heads thinking, what was that about? He had to explain them to his disciples. Here Isaiah explains what this parable's about to his listeners and to us as we listen in. He hits his point home, and as we read these from verse 8 onwards, we need to be listening carefully, because these are the things that we need to avoid if we're going to produce a good crop. If we're going to be fruitful as disciples of Jesus Christ, these are things that are dangerous for us, things that will mess us up. First of all, we read in verse 8 that they were greedy. They had a greed for property and for possessions. They were land grabbers. They were forcing others off the land. They were buying up the land around them, and they were making sure that there was no room for anybody else, because they wanted to have a lot of land and to live in splendid isolation. And then in verse 9, I'm going to run through these verses fairly quickly. The judgment of the Lord in this is, your houses will become desolate. You want to be alone, you'll be alone. And you and I will know plenty of people, perhaps, who are lonely and unfulfilled and living, so say, in the houses of their dreams. The fields will become useless, in verse 10 it says. A 10-acre field will produce a bath of wine. I've had to do some research on this week. I've been researching diligently wine. And also, what's an acre? Because, you know, I'm from the town. I don't know what an acre looks like. An acre, fortunately, is roughly the size of a football pitch. That I do understand. So if you can imagine 10 football pitches glued together, then you've got an idea of what 10 acres looks like here. So 10 football pitches will produce a bath of wine. Hopefully there's a footnote there, because I guess it depends on the size of your bath. But the footnote says about 22 litres, I think, from memory. It's essentially saying from 10 football pitches of vineyards, you're going to get 30 bottles of wine. I'm no expert, but that doesn't sound like a lot to me. So I did some further research into wine, the lengths I go to. Conservatively, and it depends on what crop you're growing, what variety of grape, how far close you plant them together, blah, blah, blah. Conservatively, you should get about 4 tons of fruit from an acre of grapes. There you go, you've learned something today. So you should be looking at not 30 bottles of wine, but 35,000 bottles of wine. This is the extent of the judgment on these people who think they can do these things. They make these plans, and actually, instead of the 35,000 bottles and this huge wine press that they've constructed, they're eking out just 30 bottles. And the crops will fail as well, as we read, in terms of them planting. They plant more than they harvest. They've got all these great plans, but they're going to come to nothing. So the warning here is for us not to be like people who are too greedy for stuff, too materialistic. These are also people living for leisure. Verses 11 and 12 paint a fairly ugly picture. These are 24-hour party people. Drink is what gets them out of bed in the morning. Now, you see this, don't you, on cross-channel ferries, 8 o'clock in the morning. You're going to the continent, perhaps, if you're lucky enough to go on holiday there. And there are all these people with pints of lager, and you think, how on earth do they do that? Drink is what gets them out of bed in the morning. Drink is what also stops them going to bed at night, it says in those verses. Their aim is to get hammered, or in more biblical language, inflamed with wine. And they turn the music up, the lyre and the flute, and they party. And that's what they live for. That hedonistic lifestyle. And yet again, woe on you people who do that, because the judgment on the drinkers, and this will be no surprise to you if you've had any history of drinking yourself, is they will have no understanding, especially no understanding of God. You'll be parched with thirst, ironically. The land hungry will end up hungry. The grave will claim them. They'll be brought low and humbled in verses 13 to 15. The party is over. And then the rest of the stink fruit is listed in quick succession. And I've just called it under an umbrella term here. They're living in defiance of God from verse 18 onwards. There is out and out defiance of God. And there's a lovely picture there, a gruesome picture really, but a very vivid one, that they tie themselves to sin with cords and they pull it along thinking, yeah, we can play with this. This is something that we can engage in. And they end up bound to wickedness with cart ropes. And it seems to me that there's a spiral downwards there between little thin cords that they think they're messing about with sin. They end up in bondage in these big cart ropes and unable to escape the wickedness as they slide further and further into their sin. And then that note of defiance, a terrible note of defiance in verse 19, let's see God at work. I think the sense of that is, let's see him stop me. He's always let me do this before. I'm okay, I can do this. And then self-justification, which is something I touched upon last time I was here. You know, the fact that we're world class at being able to give a reason why it's okay for me to do this. Here, they do it by redefining what is good and what is evil. And if they have a Bible and they pick it up and they read it, they think, well, that doesn't really apply so much today, does it? That was a cultural thing. We're more sophisticated now. They were a bit primitive back then. We know better. Terrible arrogance. That arrogance and that conceit in verse 21. Society is different. We've got to adapt. Falling for the idea that they know better than the people before them. Falling even worse for the idea that they think they know better than God. That's what it boils down to. We're never quite so explicit in expressing it that way, maybe. Pretending to be wise, they became fools. And they pervert the cause of justice, verses 22 and 23. It's a wonderful picture language here. These people are heroes. They are heroes at drinking wine. They are champions at mixing drinks. It's like there are medals for it, and they're going to attend the ceremony and get hung a medal around their neck for services to cocktails or something. Did you see Mike Ashley? I think he's still in court. Maybe it's settled now. I don't know. But Mike Ashley is in court at the moment over some bizarre law case about a deal that he did in the pub, because apparently that's how he did his business deals in the pub. What a recipe for disaster that was. At one point, somebody pointed out that at one of these business meetings, he drank 11 pints with 11 vodka chasers. Now, even as a three-day meeting, I think I'd struggle with that. And this was all in one evening. And he had to give evidence in court to say, really? Did this really happen? And I'm going to sanitize this quote a little bit because it's slightly rude. But he said in court, I like to get drunk. I'm a power drinker. Since when was that a thing, by the way? I'm a power drinker. My thing is not to drink regularly, it's to binge drink. I'm trying to get drunk. Will you accept that? I was drinking to get inflamed with wine and have a good night out. This is the man who founded Sports Direct. He's a billionaire at least once over. And actually, he's not even paying the minimum wage in his warehouse. He was found guilty of this a year or two ago. Somebody who denies justice to the innocent and is a champion at mixing drinks. And in response to these challenges that are laid down by God, sometimes by our words, our attitudes, and our actions, prove yourself, God. Well, there's a new intensity to the judgment against them. Verses 24 and 25 point out that judgment will surely come. Your roots as a nation will shrivel and decay. There will be fire. The mountains will shake. It's God of the moving mountains. There will be bodies in the streets. And how will this happen? Verse 26 to the end. It's going to be open season for the nations around. And these proud and arrogant nations who think they're powerful and are able to come in and do something on their own terms will actually... God's in control of this as well. He's only got a whistle. And he summons the superpowers. And they're in. It's that simple. God is so much in control in this. And God has removed his protection. He's knocked down the hedge and the wall. They're no longer hedged in the way that they were. And so you've got these six stink fruits and these six woes, despair and sorrow over the bad fruit that God's people are producing. And it's all very well me giving the easy example of Mike Ashley, but actually Isaiah isn't really talking to him. He's talking to us. He's talking to us as God's people. So how about us? Have we become so caught up with acquiring stuff that that's become bigger than serving God? Bigger in terms of how we use our finances. Bigger in terms of how we use our time. Have we bought into the mindset of some of the people around us who perhaps, and not everybody does this, but many of them living for the next pay packet, the next promotion, the next job move, the next holiday, the exciting retirement that they're saving up for? It's really easy to adopt the values of everybody around us, isn't it? Because we get messages all the time saying, this is the way to live. This is living. This is the life. John Piper tells a story about something that he defines as a tragedy. In his book, Don't Waste Your Life, he says this: I'll tell you what a tragedy is. I'll show you how to waste your life. Consider this story from the Reader's Digest, 1998. A couple took early retirement from their jobs in the Northeast 5 years ago when he was 59 and she was 51. Some of us think we'll never retire. 59 and 51. Now they live in Punta Gorda, Florida, where they cruise on their 30-foot trawler, play softball, and collect shells. Sounds like they're living the dream, doesn't it? Lots of people would love this. He continues, picture them before Christ on the great day of judgment. Look, Lord, see my shells. This is all we've got to show for our lives, that we've devoted our lives to just wandering along beaches, picking up trinkets. Then that is a tragedy, because it's not a life lived necessarily for the Lord. So maybe we need to think about the stuff that we end up collecting and acquiring and perhaps lusting after. Or perhaps we need to think about what we're drinking. Now, I would be a hypocrite. It's a great picture, isn't it? I'd be a hypocrite to advocate teetotalism. But the Bible is clear that we shouldn't be people who get drunk. We certainly shouldn't be the kind of people that are described here who get up in the morning to have a drink and don't go to bed because they're still drinking. And yet I will know, and you will know people in this culture as well, people who tell you quite openly, quite honestly, almost boastfully, I'm going to get wrecked tonight because I've had a big week, I've had a busy week, I've worked hard, I deserve this. I'm going to go out and get hammered or inflamed with wine. Going out to do that, so these are respectable professional people, by the way. Going out to do that is not fulfilling, as some of us know, to our cost, and it's certainly not honouring to God. I came to faith from a background of going out and getting drunk fairly regularly. I was too poor to do it very often. But God really spoke to me when I was reading the Bible about this, the fact that I needed to change that, that this was not an honouring way to live if I'm living now under new management as a new lifestyle. And as a result, I stopped drinking alcohol for 3 years because I knew that I needed to change that. God helped me to do that. We need to ask ourselves, is drink stopping us producing a good crop? It might not be that we're incapacitated. It might just be that we are just focused on sitting with a bottle of wine on our own rather than visiting somebody else. Is drink getting in the way? Or are we carrying on with behaviour that we know is wrong, but we figure, well, God's going to turn a blind eye? We need to be careful, don't we, that those cords of sin don't become great cart ropes of bondage as we wrap ourselves up in something that we find so hard to escape. And we can become defiant about our behaviour. We can get to a stage where we've changed all our morality. And things that we once said was, no, that's definitely off limits, I shouldn't do those things, suddenly they're not sin anymore. Because we can, so say, justify themselves to ourselves. We need to be careful about that. An ironic Facebook comment that somebody posted on a discussion that was going on about people changing their theology. Somebody commented this. As society moves on, I am finding my theology is changing to fit in with it. As a result, in order to justify my new positions, I have to cherry pick an entirely different set of Bible verses to back my theology up. It is quite exhausting. We've got to be careful with that, haven't we? At the end of Judges, there's that really telling phrase that appears once or twice about God's people who did everything as they saw fit. They were the arbiters of what they could and couldn't do. In those days, they had no king, so they did what they saw fit. In their defiance or indifference to God, they just did their own thing. We must not let that be the case for us. God expects us to produce a fruit in keeping with our repentance in our lives. I wonder this morning, might the Lord say to us, to you and to me, as he did to his people through Isaiah, what more could I have done for you? I gave you my son. I'm expecting through the regeneration of new birth, I'm expecting to see good fruit. I'm expecting to see a good crop. Where is the justice that is expecting as rights are wronged, whether it's on a small scale in our family, in our workplace, whether it's on a global scale? Where is righteousness, these things, this fruit that God is looking for us for in our lives? Where's the right living? Where's the right relationship going on here? Where is the fruit of the Spirit? You heard a great talk last week about the fruit of the Spirit that's expected to be cultivated in our lives. How are we doing on those things? God is looking for fruit in our lives, and he expects to find it. And he has every right to. And as he looks at you and me, what does he find? This morning, it's the easiest thing in the world for me to make you feel guilty. Because none of us measure up, do we? None of us are as fruitful as we should be. Isaiah's prophecy is a challenge to us, but it's also a great source of hope for us too. And later in his book, in Isaiah 53, he prophesies of someone who was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. And the punishment that brought peace was on him, and by his wounds we're healed. All of us, we all like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all the wrongdoing, all the rubbish, all the bad fruit, all the stink fruit in our lives. He's laid on Jesus at the cross. He poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors. And he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. To the people that heard Isaiah's song for the very first time, they didn't know that this was going to happen. We know that this has happened. Otherwise, Isaiah 5 is a call to pull up our socks and do better, try harder. And to be sure, we probably need to do that. But we can't make up for this on our own. Only Christ was able to pay the price for all our wickedness. And then finally, in John chapter 15, we think, well, our fruit is rubbish. As vines, we are pretty pathetic. And Jesus reminds us in John chapter 15, I'm going to read these verses as we close. I am the true vine, and my Father is the gardener. He cuts off every branch in me that bears no fruit, while every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes so it will be even more fruitful. You're already clean because of the word I've spoken to you. Remain in me, as I also remain in you. No branch can bear fruit by itself. It must remain in the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you remain in me. I am the vine. You are the branches. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. We don't always believe that last bit, do we? We think we can do certain things on our own. Apart from Jesus, we can do nothing. Nothing of eternal significance. Nothing that's going to last. Jesus is the fruitful vine in the way that we never could be. And we produce a good crop by being in him and remaining in him. We cannot do it on our own. And as we move towards taking bread and wine together to celebrate all that Christ did for us, this is the picture, one of the pictures that came up when I was looking on Google Images for pictures of ruined vineyards. And what a beautiful symbol this is of our own ruined vineyards and the fact that Christ came in, those crosses that they'd trained wires across so they could train the vines along. The cross has dealt with it all. The fact that we've perhaps produced some stink fruits. And Jesus enables us to produce a good crop. And so as we prepare to take communion together, let's just be quiet for a moment.